Recordings are now started.
Great. Thank you, Chris. Well, welcome, everyone. Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening to all. Welcome to the new GTLD Subsequent Procedures call on the 14th of June, 2018. In the interest of time today, there will be no roll call. Attendance will be taken via the Adobe Connect room. So if you happen to be only on the audio bridge, would you please let yourself be known now?
Hi, this is Jeff. For now, I'm only on audio, but trying to get on Adobe.
As noted. And as a reminder to all participants, if you would please state your name before speaking for transcription purposes, and please keep your phones and microphones on mute when not speaking to avoid any background noise. With this, I'll hand the meeting back over to Cheryl Langdon Orr. Please begin.
Thank you very much, Michelle. We appreciate the great start. A couple of minutes late, and we do have a lot to do today, but I'm sure we'll be able to get through it all in the time allocated. Well, I'm hopeful we will be. My name is Cheryl Langdon. I'm one of the two co-chairs of the subsequent procedures for new GTLD's policy development program, along with Jeff Newman, who will be joining us in the Adobe Connect room when his technology permits him to. And on today's call, the first part of the agenda, other than reviewing the agenda, and to remind you, you have been sent out the sections that we will be covering today, which is 1.8 and 1.9, we will also be taking a moment, I hope, to look at steps forward as we go through ICANN 61 and beyond to publishing of our initial report. But let's first of all ask for any changes to any statements of interest. If anyone has a change to their statement of interest that they'd like to declare now, please do so. Not hearing anything, let's get on to the substantive part of today's work, which of course is the continuation of the review of the initial report. Now, unfortunately, what I'm seeing on my screen is the little circle going around with Adobe Presenter on it, so I'm not seeing the shared document. Staff, Steve or Emily or Julie, can you confirm that everyone but me is able to see what we should be looking at? Oh, and now I'm beginning to see something. Excellent. Okay. First of all, if we can work out what page we're going to, what page is 1.8 on? Can someone help me while it's loading? Oh, okay. You're taking us to it. Thanks. Great. Okay. Page four. Thank you so much. And if you can adjust your screens now so you've got a decent view. Mine is, I think, it's something like 40% at the moment, which makes it unreadable. We'll start with 1.8, dispute proceedings, which is, as I think Christopher's voice told me, page four on your 22-page document for today. Jeff, are you in the room yet? I see you now as a presenter.
Yeah, I'm in the room, but from my iPad, so it doesn't. I mean, I can see the documents and everything. I can see some of the chat, but you might have to just help me out with people in the chat room.
Well, I'm more than happy to manage chat if you want to take over the quick read through, because you set a good pace last week when I last call when I listened to it, and I don't want to jinx our good run through. So back to you, and I'll look after chat.
Okay, sounds good. And I can't tell, maybe because it's my on my iPad, but does everyone have control over the document, or is it locked?
Jeff Shaw here. We have scroll control now. It's just been released.
Okay, but I see someone scrolling it for me.
In fact, it's now changed. When I said, Cheryl, we were fine, so it's going to and fro. Emily, can you tell us what's going on, please?
Hi, Cheryl. This is Emily from staff. So unfortunately, we're not able to unsync documents anymore. It's a new rule for security reasons, and unfortunately, the document needs to remain synced because of that. So I do apologize. It is unfortunate, but that's where we are right now and what we're working with. So appreciate everyone's patience, and we'll do our best to make sure that the document is moving along with what you're doing. And it might also be helpful for some to follow along with their own version of the document from the agenda. So again, apologies and thanks for that.
Thanks, Emily. Cheryl, for the record, and can I just express on behalf of what I suspect is everybody's opinion on this call, how extremely annoying that is. I thought it was unsynced because Jeff and I are listed as presenters, and I suspect if I push the arrows on my computer, as perhaps with Jeff as well, we would indeed be forwarding the document. So my apologies, I thought it was unsynced. Please feel free, staff, to let the IT people know how undelighted we are with this new rule. Thanks, Emily, anyway. Yes, so Cheryl's grumbling again. Feel free to quote me. Jeff, back to you.
Okay, thanks, Cheryl. And so I'm going to be going along in my own copy. So if you guys can help, that would be great. We are on page 1.8.1. We have two sections left. So, I'm sorry, two overall sections, 1.8 and 1.9. And so 1.8 deals with dispute proceedings. So the first part is on objections. The second part is on accountability mechanisms. So on the objections front, there are five recommendations deal with the issue of objections in some sort of way, and one implementation guideline. So the four recommendations are the first one, recommendation two, strings must not be confusingly similar to an existing top-level domain. Recommendation three, strings must not infringe the legal rights of others that are recognized or enforceable under generally accepted and internationally recognized principles of law. And then it goes on to cite some of the examples. recommendation six, strings must not be contrary to generally accepted legal norms relating to morality and public order that are enforceable under generally accepted and internationally recognized principles of law. And then that too goes on to cite some examples as well, including the Paris Convention for the Protection of Industrial Property, as well as the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Recommendation 12, dispute resolution and challenge processes must be established prior to the start of the process. Recommendation 20, an application will be rejected if it's determined, based on public comments or otherwise, that there is substantial opposition to it from among significant established institutions of the economic sector or cultural or language community to which it is targeted or which it is intended to support. And then finally, implementation guideline P, the following process definitions and guidelines refer to recommendation 20. And so there's some process ones. We are now on the next page, which is page 5, I believe. Although I'm not sure why the Adobe Connect is on page 20. But we are on page 5 of the document. The principles are opposition must be objection-based. Determination will be made by a dispute resolution panel constituted for that purpose. And the objector must provide verifiable evidence that is an established institution of the community. And then it says, perhaps like the RSTEP pool of panelists from which a small panel would be constituted for each objection. Guidelines, the relevant guidelines, the task of the panel is the determination of substantial opposition. And then it goes on to define those terms. There's the definition of substantial, definition of significant portion, definition of community. And this one's important. It says community should be interpreted broadly, and will include, for example, an economic sector, a cultural community, or a linguistic community. It may be a closely related community which believes it is impacted. So it's a very broad definition there. Then definition of implicitly targeting, established, and finally an established institution. It says that exceptional circumstances include but are not limited to a reorganization, merger, or an inherently younger community. And then the following ICANN organizations are defined as established institutions. So we have the GAC, ALAC, GNSO, CCNSO, and ASO. And then there's a definition of formal existence as well as definition of detriment. And I was wrong. There's one other implementation guideline, which is guideline R, which states that once formal objections or disputes are accepted for review, there will be a cooling-off period to allow parties to resolve the dispute or objection before review by the panel is initiated. Any questions on the background from the 2007 policy plus the what we're going to get into now is how it was implemented. So any questions on the policy, the original policy?
Hello, do you hear me?
Yes, Caboose, please.
Yeah, this is Caboose. Yes, I'm on audio bridge. Unfortunately, I am not connected to the system after a lot of waiting and so on and so forth. So I have one question to raise. I understand that the culture does not want that anyone raise any question whatsoever, because they said that the purpose of the meeting is to verify whether the report reflects the discussions. No additional question, no clarification should be made, because they should leave that for the public comment. Is that right?
So if they are purely questions, sorry, this is Jeff Newman, if they are purely questions of clarification, in other words, I don't understand what's written there, I don't think that's what we discussed, or I don't understand it, that is perfectly appropriate. But if we are giving our opinions on whether we like or dislike what's there, or whether we think something new should be added, those are the things we're trying to avoid. So I don't know if Cheryl, you want to provide any additional guidance, but that's the guidance that I would give.
Yes, if I may, it's Cheryl here. Yes, I also just wanted to follow up with what you said, that that is what we've been requesting all along, but we do note that when people have put substantive comments in, often to the list, that these are the sorts of comments that we will be seeking through public comment. We are taking note of those. We are accumulating those. We will record those as they are written, simply as a capture, to make sure that none of those inputs are lost. And Jeff, I don't know whether you can see it, but after Caboose responds again, you also have Christopher with his hands raised.
Okay. Yeah, but your text, it doesn't say that. Your text say that the purpose of this meeting is to examine or verify whether the documents reflect the discussion is work track 1, 2, 3, and 4. Any other questions should be taken or should be raised during the public comments or through the email reflector, but not at the call. This is what I understand. I'm not objecting. I'm not doing anything. I just want to understand that this is what you put in written form at the beginning of the text, of the invitation to the call.
Cheryl here. Yes, that is correct. That's why it's written that way.
Thank you. I don't want to waste your time. Thank you very much. I'm now listening. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Caboose, and thank you, Cheryl. Christopher, please.
Thank you, Jeff. Thank you, Cheryl. Christopher Wilkinson, for the record. I'm just unmuting. I think I'm online with you all. I understand Caboose's frustrations. It's not quite clear, but I don't want to mention about that this evening. Steve's invitation said very specifically that please submit your comments to the working group mailing list, which I have done, and you've got it. My only point just now is that the co-chairs and the co-leads, I think, need to do a little bit more than they've done to date about the coordination of issues and discussions between the different work tracks. I've come across several instances where one work track is saying one thing and another work track is saying something quite different. Somebody somewhere, whether it's Steve or whether it's the co-chairs, I have no opinion, but somebody somewhere needs to improve the coordination between the discussions in the different work tracks. From my personal point of view, which you have seen in my comment, there is a general issue between work track 5 and the extensive discussion here of objection procedures. There's a significant point of view, which I share in work track 5, that objection procedures are completely inappropriate for geographical names, and that we wish to see a significant shift towards prior approval or non-objection for applications for geographical names. This is not the place to go into this in any detail, but I think we need a caveat or a qualification somewhere up front in this document that the objection procedures do not necessarily apply to all categories of the new applications, subject to further work in the competent work tracks concerned. Thank you.
Thank you, Christopher. I would just try to think about that suggestion, and I almost think of it as kind of the opposite way, because Work Track 5 hasn't gotten this far in their work. To put something in there, I mean, I'm fine with putting something in there that says that, and we are essentially, that Work Track 5 is not, you know, this report doesn't include the recommendations from Work Track 5 on geographic names, and therefore they may have different outcomes with respect to a number of these areas that may overlap. But I don't think it's a good idea to put something very vague in there saying that this doesn't necessarily apply to anything, because then it's very vague as to what it does apply to. So we'll take that question back and figure out a way in which we, as kind of Ruben says in the chat, we can't really have a conflict with Work Track 5 since their initial report's not yet out. So we understand there's discussions going on, but we will make it clear that the material we're putting out is only with respect to what work tracks, is with respect to everything but geographic names at the top level.
Excuse me, can I make a comment, please?
Yes, please, Caruso.
Yes, my comment is as follows. There are 4 work tracks. Not everybody was able to attend in all these 4 tracks. This call, an invitation for similar call, was the only opportunity for those who have not been able to attend all of these 4 tracks. When listening to the introductions of the report, whatever you call them, preliminary or whatever, or progress, raise their questions. It is not expected that the co-chair said your question could be raised during the public comment, or your question could be raised to the email reflector. We believe, or I believe, that this is the only opportunity for those who have not attended the 4 track, when listening to the report, raise their questions in order that the problems be at least clear for everybody. But unfortunately, it seems that this opportunity does not exist. And it is a pity.
Okay.
It is really a pity. Yeah.
Thanks, Caboose. We understand your feelings. We understand that people can't attend every single work track. There is a public comment period coming up, and then afterwards we will be analyzing all of the public comments. And so for those areas that you are able to pay attention to and that you want to make sure you're involved in, please make sure that you're involved in those discussions as well. But we do have to move on because we do want to get through all this material. So I have now rejoined Adobe Connect from my computer. I see that Greg is in the queue, so Greg, please. Thanks.
Thanks, Greg Chatton. Just briefly, I actually want to agree with Caboose on the last point, and it's part of a broader concern about the work being done in the work tracks versus being done in the working group, and a concern that the preliminary report is essentially treating the outcomes of the work tracks as working group preliminary outcomes, subject only to clarification and proper expression of those terms. And I think that is, we need to clarify if that is in fact the methodology, or if the working group as a whole is really, whether the work is going to be brought back to the working group. And I think, you know, it's one thing to deal with it at this point in kind of the public comment stage, and this is a very preliminary report. It's all kind of a almost like a test bed, that, as opposed to a preliminary report. As I've said before, it's probably the report before the preliminary report. But at some point, we're going to have to either clarify that the work tracks are dispositive and that if you're not there, you're not in the right place, or that the work tracks are reporting back to the working group, which is going to then deal with those at the working group level, which might include, you know, rejecting the work of the work track or significantly changing the work of the work track. We need to be very clear on the hierarchy and methodology that we're doing here. And it's one thing to put out the preliminary report, which is very preliminary and could change significantly, but I think after that point, we really need to know where the rubber hits the road. Because like Caboose, I don't want to be spending time on calls where I have no influence really on the decisions being made and missing calls where the decisions are being made. Thank you.
Yes, but I'm very, very sorry that I missed all these opportunities. I have been waken up at midnight very early morning and was not in a position due to the process or procedure not to make a comment on the spot, and I was referred back to the discussions on the public comment or after the public comment. I thought that still I am on a strong belief that this is a good opportunity that everyone or anyone was not able to attend the four tracks to raise the question and receive reply to the question, but not to be addressed to the public comment. This is the process that I am not convinced is correct. It is not correct. Thank you.
Thank you, everyone. Thank you, Caboose. Thank you, Greg. Thank you, Anne, for your comments on the chat. We have noted your objections. In fact, the objections have been noted many times. But that said, it also has been discussed many times that this was the process we were following. This is, again, just input to the preliminary report. We are, when we send out the revisions, making it clear that these are work track, that the individual recommendations are work track recommendations, not full working group recommendations, so that will be represented accurately. And the point is to get some things out there for public comment. I will save a few minutes at the end of this under AOB, I guess we have another section, next steps, to talk about our thoughts on how we handle this going forward. But with that, I really want to get to the substance of this. Your objections are noted. We understand them, but if we can move on, because now we're almost a half hour into this and have not really gotten any questions on the substance. So moving back to 1.8.1b, how was all of this implemented, in the 2012 round. In the final report, the GNSO recommended that dispute resolution and challenge processes must be established prior to the start of the process. In the GAC principles regarding new GTLDs, Principle 3.3 states, if individual GAC members or other governments express formal concerns about any issues related to new GTLDs, the ICANN board should fully consider those concerns and clearly explain how it will address them. In support of the guidance from the GNSO and the GAC, Module 3 of the 2012 Applicant Guidebook defines the following processes. And so Section 3.1 describes GAC advice on new GTLDs. That's a process intended to address applications that are identified by governments to be problematic. For example, those potentially that violate national law or raise sensitivities. It provides that the GAC advice must be filed by the close of the objection filing period. According to the guidebook, GAC advice could take one of three forms. And so there's the three forms that are on there, either that that there's consensus that a particular application shouldn't proceed, which creates a strong presumption for the ICANN board that the application should not be approved. The second kind is the GAC may advise the board that there are concerns about a particular application. The ICANN board is expected to enter into dialogue with the GAC to understand the scope of the concerns. ICANN board is also expected to provide a rationale for its decision. And the third is that the GAC advises ICANN that an application should not proceed unless remediated, which raises a strong presumption for the board that the application should not proceed unless there's a remediation method available in the guidebook, such as securing the approval of one or more governments that is implemented by the applicant, and there's some cites to those. There's a Section 3.2 that describes the public objection and dispute resolution process through which parties with standing can file formal objections with designated third-party dispute resolution providers on specific applications based on the following grounds. So we have the string confusion objection, existing legal rights objection, limited public interest objection, and a community objection. In order to bring these objections, objectors not only had to meet the substantive requirements for the applicable objection type, but they also had to satisfy certain standing requirements to have their objections considered. A description of the substantive as well as the standing requirements are set forth on pages 3-5 through 3-8 of the new GTLD applicant guidebook. As a result of a number of discussions between the ICANN board and the GAC in 2010 through 2011, a newly created role was created called the independent objector. Section 3.2.5 describes the role of the independent objector, who is in a position to file objections when doing so serves the best interests on the public who use the global internet. The independent objector was supposed to not act on behalf of any particular persons or entities, but solely in the best interests of the public who use the global internet. The independent objector was to file objections against highly objectionable GTLD applications to which no objection had been filed, and was limited to filing two types of objections, either a limited public interest objection or a community objection. The independent objector is granted standing to file objections on these enumerated grounds, notwithstanding the regular standing requirements for such objections. So that is how the guidebook implemented the recommendations, the final report of the GNSO. So I see Christopher Wilkinson has his hand raised. Remember, this is how the guidebook was supposed to handle it, not whether we agree with what they did or disagree, but this is a description of how the guidebook handled that advice. Thanks. Christopher, please.
Okay. Jeff, I'm following you with some difficulty because all the clauses that you refer to are not in the document that is in front of me. I want to make two very simple questions. For all the participants who don't know me, I do not represent the GAC in any sense whatsoever. But for historical reasons, I may have a certain sentiment as to what you might be. I'm on page 7 and 8 of the document. I don't think it's remotely possible to ask objectors worldwide to bear the cost of their objection. First of all, I don't think I'm in the second bullet of paragraph little c. Steve, it would be really nice if you could number all the paragraphs. The bearing the cost accordingly. Out of the question, brothers and sisters, please don't entertain illusions. And secondly, on page 8, I see why the second bullet speaks about obliging people to shut up about categories and only query individual applications. Who is going to enforce this? The chances of the chair of the GAC or the secretary of the GAC, I don't even know whether Tom is on the call, being able to discipline 150 governments to respect that second bullet, it's remote. Please, could somebody go through this with a significant degree of political and administrative experience and try and avoid total fantasies? Thank you.
Okay, thanks, Christopher. Is there anyone else wants to get in the queue that wants to comment on the background on Section B, because we are not yet on Section C? Okay, not hearing anyone else that wants to comment on B. We're moving on to C. The work track seeks input on the following preliminary recommendations. So these are, again, says the work track. We're trying to be clear, it's not the working group. So here's the first preliminary recommendation. A transparent process for ensuring that panelists, evaluators, and independent objectors are free from conflicts of interest must be developed. Second one, for all types of objections, the parties to a proceeding should be given the opportunity to agree upon a single panelist or a three-person panel, bearing the cost accordingly. The third one is ICANN must publish for each type of objection all supplemental rules as well as all criteria to be used by panelists for the filing of, response to, and evaluation of each objection. Such guidance for decision-making by panelists must be more detailed than what was available prior to the 2012 round. Third recommendation, the quick look mechanism should be extended. It currently applies to only the limited public interest objection, but it should be extended to all objection types. Quick look is designed to identify and eliminate frivolous and or abusive objections. And the last recommendation, provide applicants with the opportunity to amend an application or add public interest commitments in response to concerns raised in an objection. Are there any questions on those recommendations? Okay, I'll see if anyone's typing anything. So Justine Chu asks, the first bullet, did the work track consider who would administer the process? So the first bullet says a transparent process for ensuring that panelists, evaluators, and independent objectors are free from conflicts of interest must be developed. I see Karen on the call. I try to scroll down to see if Robin's on the call. No, so Karen, I don't know if this was one of your subparts or whether this was one of Karen's, but do you have an answer to that question?
My apologies, Jeff. My attention was diverted elsewhere here in my office. Could you repeat the question again, and I will be glad to.
Sure. So the question was, did the work track consider who would administer the process of making sure that in bullet one, panelists, evaluators, and objectors are free from conflicts of interest? Did we get into that much detail?
In the discussions, we did not spend a lot of time on that. We just discussed that during the selection process, whomever was appointing the panels, should take care to make those assurances, whether it was going to be staff, ICANN.org, choosing vendors through RFP processes, or board appointments. We did not go into whose responsibility it was, but just it was a general statement that whomever is tasked with appointing whichever panelist, evaluators, or the independent objector in the next round should be obligated to ensure that there is freedom from conflict of interest, and that everything is stated up front as to where the interests lie of those evaluators. Does that help?
Yeah, I think that does help. And Justine says, can we pose that question for feedback? Do we already pose that question? If not, Karen, what are your thoughts on including a question of who do we see as administering a process for ensuring a lack of conflicts? Okay, I'm not hearing any objections. Sorry, Karen, go ahead.
No, my only comment to Justine's question was I don't have any comment. I don't have any problem including that as one of our asks for feedback, but I was going to defer to you or Cheryl or staff, someone that was involved earlier on, if there are certain delineations already made that we may need to be aware of that we are not, as to whose job that would be. So would that ask be appropriate? And, should we point to the mechanisms that are existing that were used last time to pick these evaluators, panelists, the IO, and then ask, are we needing more?
Well, this is Jeff. I certainly think it would be an appropriate question to ask about who would administer the conflicts of interest process. I think that was the question. So I don't have an issue with adding a question that says something like that. Cheryl is typing. Okay, I know I see still that Anne is typing on what is in the guidelines of the PDP manual. So, yes, Anne, we're all fully aware. The leaders are fully aware of what's in the PDP manual. We're fully aware that it says should, and the leaders met and agreed that we were not going to include level of consensus for a number of reasons we've discussed on past calls. Be happy to discuss it again, and we will write something about that in the preamble, which you all should see shortly. Okay, any other questions on the bullet points on Section C? Okay. I'm not sure why. So it says, what are options? I think these next parts, it's under Section D, but I think it should be on Section E. I think it's in the wrong place, but because there's questions here on GAC advice and early warnings, but I think that was supposed to be under Section E as opposed to D. Could someone confirm, or am I just seeing it weird on my screen? Just waiting for someone to type.
Hi, Jeff.
Emily, go ahead.
My hand up. This is Emily from staff. So I think that we did indeed put them under D, not because these are alternatives of one another, but because they're potential recommendations that could be considered but are not necessarily at the level that we that the leaders felt like they were recommendations to put forward under C. So they can be moved elsewhere, but that was the rationale for putting them under D. Thanks.
Oh, thank you. Yes, you're right, Emily. Thanks. Okay. So just to repeat that, these were other items that were discussed but didn't quite rise to the level of recommendations, but we are seeking feedback on them. So these are the concepts in Section D. The first bullet point says GAC advice must include a clearly articulated rationale, including the national or international law upon which it is based. Future GAC advice and board action thereupon or categories of GTLDs should be issued prior to the finalization of the next applicant guidebook. Any GAC advice issued after the publication period has begun must apply to individual strings only, based on the merits and details of the application, not on groups or classes of applications. Third bullet point, individual governments should not be allowed to use the GAC advice mechanism absent full consent or support by the GAC. The objection, my throat here. The objecting government should instead file a string objection utilizing the existing ICANN procedures. Christopher, you have a question, please.
I'll pass for the moment. Carry on. I'll come back.
Okay, I was having a coughing fit, so that's why I was hoping you would ask the question while I could just grab something to drink, but okay. Cheryl, do you want to take over for 1 second and just grab some water real quick?
I certainly can. I don't want to hear you expire live to air, Jeff. That would be very, very problematic. Christopher Cheryl here. Is that hand old or is it put up fresh? Okay, thanks, Christopher. Appreciate that. Okay, so we're looking here at the moment in the question of the Section D parts. Emily has explained what the rationale was. She also opened up the option that if it is the view of the plenary, we could in fact combine it all. So what I'd like to do while Jeff recovers is ask you to let us know in chat or put your hand up to make your opinions known on how you feel about the split between the Section D and Section E at this stage. I realise you're on the fourth bullet, Jeff, but you didn't actually, find out whether or not we needed to roll them together. So let me ask a relatively clear question, I hope, and that is everyone comfortable with the current split between what we have under Section D and what we have under Section E? And if you have a problem with the current layout, you can let us know in chat. So we'll note that, and if it comes in chat to a significant extent, we will look at making those changes. So now coming to the fourth bullet point, and the screen is so tiny on my laptop, it is a strain for me to read. But anyway, it is the following. The application process should define a specific time period during which GAC early warnings can be issued and require the governments issuing such warnings, to include both written rationale or basis and specific action requested to the applicant. The applicant should have an opportunity to engage in direct dialogue in response to such warning and amend the application during a specified time period. Another option might be the inclusion of public interest commitments, PICs in brackets, to address any outstanding concern about the application. And it is a shame that Jamie Baxter isn't on the call today, because I should note for the record that that he's had a lot of input into, if memory serves, this particular matter. So comments on that? Not seeing anyone. If I can, without making everyone dizzy, move my screen, which will move all of yours, to the next section. What specified questions are the PVP working group seeking feedback on? And here we have our questions, which if you have any additions to make, please do so. The first one is role of GAC advice. And it is as follows. Some have stated that Section 3.1 of the Applicant Guidebook creates a veto right, in inverted commas, for the GAC to any new TLD application or stream. Is there any validity to this statement? Please explain. The second point is, given the changes to the ICANN bylaws that with respect to the Board's consideration of GAC advice, is it still necessary to maintain the presumption that if the GAC provides advice against a string or an application, in brackets, that such string or application should not proceed? And the third point under the role of GAC advice is, does the presumption that a string will not proceed, in inverted commas, limit ICANN's ability to facilitate a solution that both accepts GAC advice, but also allows for the delegation of a string if the underlying concerns that gave rise to the objection were addressed? Does that presumption unfairly prejudice other legitimate interests? And with that, hopefully Jeff has survived and hasn't been driven further into unfortunate coping mechanisms, as I'm reading in the chat as well, and we can ask for any comments on those questions. Is there any other question that you'd like to suggest we raise at this point, specifically with the role of GAC advice? But we believe that these three points reasonably and effectively pick up the issues that the work track was interested in. Jeff, I'm going to hand back to you if you are in a condition to do so. And open the queue while we switch across.
Thanks, Cheryl. Hopefully I am better, but we'll see. I have some, basically a jug of water here now, so in front of me. So if this happens again, I will down it, and we'll see what happens. So I think you ended up at the end of the GAC advice questions, the three sub-bullets there.
So, correct.
Okay, and I don't see anyone in the queue at this point. I see some typing in there. There's Christopher says that these parameters need to be negotiated with the GAC. I doubt the GAC would recognize the authority of a work track to create conditions. Response by Rubens, that's why the GNSF PDPs have many pieces of early interaction with the GAC through the GNSF GAC liaison. And just to point out, though, that these are just questions that are going to be asked of the community. So whether they can be changed or not is a whole other question that we're not addressing at this point, or nor is it our nor is it appropriate for us to address. What we're really just getting is feedback from the community on their thoughts. Justine says that the second bullet, can we add a footnote to reference the exact changes to the ICANN bylaws that are being raised? I think that's a good question. So in the second bullet, we are talking about the section of the bylaws that talks about when the role of GAC or the role of GAC advice. So we can put a reference in there. Okay. Anyone else want to get in the queue? Okay. The next section, then, and I know we have a lot to cover here. There's a bunch of questions on the role of the independent objector. So in 2012, there was only one independent objector that was appointed. For future rounds, should there be additional independent objectors? And if so, how would they divide their work? And should it be divided by subject matter expertise? The second bullet is, in the 2012 round, all the funding for the independent objector came from ICANN. So should this continue to be the case? And if so, should there be a limit on the number of objections? In the 2012 round, bullet three, there was a requirement, sorry, page nine, that the independent objector could only object to a string if that string had no other objections filed against it based on the same round. That continued to be the case. Last bullet in this section, should the independent objector be limited to filing to only filing objections based on the two grounds enumerated in the applicant guidebook? So it's basically saying, should there be additional grounds for the independent objector to object? There's a set of general questions. Some members of the community believe that some objections were filed with the specific intent to delay the processing of applications for a particular string. So it's asking whether the community believes that this was the case, and if so, if they could provide specific examples or details about what can be done to, specific details about the objections they feel were filed with that intent and what can be done about it. The next one is, how can the quick look mechanism be improved? And then the third one is on the funding for objections filed by the ALAC. It was funded by ICANN in the 2012 round. Should that continue to be the case? Should ICANN, if it does continue, what limits should be in place, if any, on the funding? And the last sub-question there is, should applicants have the opportunity to take remediation measures in response to objections about the application under certain circumstances? If so, what under what circumstances, and should this apply to all types of objections or only certain types? Anne, please.
Yeah, just very quickly regarding independent objector. I think this, again, it's just a housekeeping thing, Jeff. I think that all the way back on page 18, and this is probably more of a note for staff, there's that question, are there other activities in the community that may serve as a dependency or future input to this topic? And we mentioned there the accountability work in relation to human rights, but there was a whole section in accountability about the independent objector, and I've got it completely wrong, and I think Cheryl will correct me if I do, there should be some possible impact coming out of that independent objector work on this IO section. Okay, it sounds like I'm talking to a wall. Does anybody remember all that stuff about recommendations?
So, this is Jeff. I know that there were recommendations about independent review in general, but I don't recall anything about an independent objector for new TLDs.
Jeff Scherer here, and you're not talking to a wall. I just didn't get off mute very quickly. Yeah, Jeff's got it right there. There's the independent review process went into great details, but the IO independent objector per se, as relating to new strings and TLDs, we didn't make any particular recommendations. Now, that said, I would think that in the section on disputes, there is a great deal, and I believe that the work track was cognizant of the outcomes of the accountability work as well, a great deal of foundational work that we could then draw on from their independent review process and independent dispute resolution processes, as they discuss those, things like the diversity of a panel, the requirement for clear and transparent processes, the requirement for fair and due abilities without a huge impulse of costs, all those sorts of things are enshrined in those recommendations from that CCWG, and that means that hopefully our recommendations later on in this section will be well founded on those better models. Does that help, Anne?
Hi, it's Anne again really quickly. Was there, Cheryl, coming out of the, gosh, I remember all this discussion about whether there should be more than one independent objector and what all of that, that came out of that work that you guys did. And I was on a few of those calls, but is that work codified somewhere? Is it done? Is it?
Well, it's not codified yet because our final meeting isn't until the Sunday prior to the ICANN 62 work.
That's what I'm referring to, Jeff, is that there's work going on there that is parallel on the IO. That was all. In accountability.
Okay, we'll take that offline and
that's page 18 sub G, subparagraph G is
okay.
Where just for staff. Yeah.
All right.
Thank
you. We'll take that. We'll do some research offline, and if it is, we'll cite that in there. Christopher Wilkinson, please. We're trying to get through this document, so.
Very quickly. Another illustration of the fantasy world. There's a question here as to whether or not an objection is supposed to delay the decision-making process. And ramifications of that question. Of course, the whole point of making an objection is to delay the process. I think that question is misformulated. Off the record, this is Christopher Wilkinson speaking, off the record, I think the independent objector has a marvelous job, provided the job comes with a bulletproof vest. Thank you.
Thank you for that, Christopher. Okay, if we move on then to community objections, these are the questions that were documented by the work track. The first one deals with dealing with the same entity applying for a TLD and filing an objection on the same TLD for another application for that TLD. So there's a question of should that continue to be allowed? The second question deals with the costs there's a perception that the costs were unpredictable and way too high. So what can be done about lowering the fees and making them more predictable while at the same time ensuring that the evaluations were both fair and comprehensive? And then in the work track, there was a proposal to allow those filing a community objection to specify public interest commitments they want to apply to the string. If the objector prevails, these picks become mandatory for any applicant that wins the contention set. What is the view of this proposal? That proposal is mentioned in the deliberation section below. Okay, when it comes to string confusion objections, the registry stakeholder group put forward a proposal to allow a single string confusion objection to be filed against all applicants for a particular string rather than requiring a unique objection to be filed against each application.
And then under the proposal, an objector could file a single objection that would extend all to all objections for the identical string. Given that an objection that encompassed several applications will still require greater work to process and review, the string confusion panel could introduce a tiered pricing structure. Each applicant for that identical string would still prepare a response to that objection. The same panel would review all documentation associated with the objection, each response reviewed on its own merit. And then the final point of their recommendation was the panel would issue a single determination that identified which applications would be in contention. Any outcome that resulted in indirect contention would be explained as part of the response. Do you support this proposal? Why or why not? Would this approach be an effective way to reduce the risk of inconsistent outcomes? And then finally, there is a question on legal rights objections. Is it appropriate for legal rights objection to be based on an infringement analysis, as was the case in 2012? Or do you believe it would be more appropriate to change the standard to one based on bad faith? Please explain. And then it talks about a WorkTrack member submitted a straw man red line edit of the applicant guidebook, which proposed changing the standard from existing legal rights being infringed to being abused, which is based on bad faith. The proposal's view is available at that link, and then asks what the view is of the community on those edits and the new standard for the objection. Are there any questions on these questions? Gigi says, I posted a comment to the list regarding string confusion resulting from exact translations of existing TLDs. Gigi, if you can, if I could put you up in the queue, if you can just quickly go over what the comment was and what the question to be. Thanks.
Sure. Do you want me to do that right now?
Yes, please.
Okay. So the comment was in regard to some concerns received from the community that were shared with the WorkTrack, and that specifically said that exact translations of existing strings in highly regulated sectors that don't employ the same safeguards should be the foundation for an objection based on string similarity. And I think it would be appropriate to include a question for public comment on whether it makes sense to have that mechanism in place, recognizing that as a situation leading to string confusion.
Thanks, Gigi. So we have a queue developing. So Anne and then Christopher, please.
Thanks, Steph. It's Anne for the transcript. This is a very minor requested change, but important. At least the trademark lawyers, I think. I don't know. Infringement was never the standard for a legal rights objection. I think everybody pretty much knows that infringement is about violations of rights that result in damages, money payments, that kind of stuff. And when you prove infringement, that's a different thing. As the WIPO rules make clear, there are three possible grounds for a legal rights objection. They're based on an unfair advantage gained by the reputation of the string, or a likelihood of confusion, or a passing off analysis. So in order to be clear with this question, that would need to be changed. And this was mentioned in the WorkTrack at the time in these discussions when the bad faith proposal came up. And it needs to be changed to strike infringement and say either, you know, say unfair advantage or likelihood of confusion, because that's all about, you know, registration. That is not about violation of rights that comes along with infringement. And it was raised in the work track.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks, Anne. I think that's the point of the question. But in the guidebook uses the term infringed. And I think that's what Paul McGrady, when he made his proposal, was talking about, changing the word infringed to abused. If you click on that proposal. So I think what it says here is moving it from infringed to abused. Yeah. So let's go back.
Yeah, it probably should just be correlated somehow to the actual rules, which don't use either of those words. But the rules state three grounds, so, yeah.
All right, we'll take that one off as well. We'll look at it, and then I think we'll check also with Paul, because I think it was his proposal that we're addressing. So we can do that. Going to Christopher, please, and then Karen.
Thank you, Jeff. This is Christopher Wilkinson. For the record, I have in front of me four very short points. The first is that with my limited knowledge, I think Anne is right about the problem of the word infringement. There are other circumstances where there are problems arising, but not necessarily that one. Secondly, for your information, I know that this is shocking to some of our participants. For your information, I believe that there are many local communities, even governments, who would defend to their utmost their rights to control the use of their geographical names, even if they do not have, by Western standards, formal legal protection. Thirdly, question of competition for different strings for the same domain. This can be readily resolved by, at least for geographical names, by the appropriate authority conducting a request for proposal and submitting a single proposal to ICANN. So I think that's enough for now. But I repeat my general exception. This whole discussion on objections is not what some of us want to see at all as applied to geographical names. Thank you.
Thanks, Christopher. And that's important to discuss in the work track five, is to make sure that the co-leads are making that part of the discussion. Anne, your hand is raised. I know, Karen, your hand was raised, but Karen, did you take your hand down?
Hi, Jeff. This is Karen. For the record, I was going to respond to Anne verbally, but I responded to her in the text as to where the term infringement came from, why we're using it in the text, and that we are working on adding some explanatory language around it, but we're not going to change that word because it is directly from the recommendation three.
Okay, thanks, Karen. Well, I know that Anne has cited something from, I guess that's the rules or the criteria of what is being used to determine an outcome in legal rights objection. Okay, moving on then, there is a fairly lengthy deliberation section, which is important because a lot of the subjects that, you know, a lot of subjects were discussed in this deliberation, in the deliberations of Work Track 3, and so hopefully they're all represented there in some way. Justine, please. All right, Justine, are you there? I knew you might be on mute.
Hi, sorry, I was trying to connect to my microphone. Justine speaking. Sorry, I put some questions in the chat, but I think because of the conversations that's going on in the chat, so it may have moved off your screen. My first question was in relation to the general questions section, the third bullet in the middle of the paragraph. I was suggesting whether we could use a bit more neutral language on the sentence that reads, if this does continue, what limits should be placed, if any, on such funding? Just to make it more neutral to say, if it does continue, should limits be placed? And if so, what? Because, you know, when you ask what limits, you're sort of suggesting that limits should be considered, but I don't think necessarily that is a neutral stance. Thanks.
Okay, thanks. Thanks, Justine. I think that's a good point, and I will check with the co-leads, but I don't think there's an objection to make those wording changes. Okay, anybody else with questions? Kurt asked the question at Karen, if this is a PDP, can it not change the previous GNSO policy? Yeah, Kurt, the question itself, if you look at the question that's being debated with the word infringement, it's basically asking, should the infringement analysis be changed? So I think that's what we're asking. I think the whole debate was whether we should have used infringement analysis or something like that, because some view that the analysis they did was not an infringement analysis at all. Okay. I think we need to move on to 1.8.2, which starts...
Jeff Cheryl here, sorry. Yeah, just really thinking we might cut here at 1.8.2, and I'm as devastated as I'm sure you are that we didn't get through all of 1.8 and indeed onto communities as 1.9 at today's call. But that's why we have one next week. But we really need to look at the work plan, because it's going to respond to some of the very important conversations and interactions that went on in chat today. So I know you probably haven't been able to watch the Skype chat, but you know, I think it's probably worthwhile breaking now and leaving 15 minutes for the work plan discussion. Thanks.
Thanks, Cheryl. Why don't we pull up the work plan? Although it was sort of based on the fact that we would get through 1.8, 1.9 today. But if we can pull that up, or Steve's actually saying, okay, just click on that link. Okay, that's another way to do it. You'll see that the hope was to basically that now that you have all the sections out of the for the initial report, at least for the substance, the meat of the report, that we are going to basically be sending out, so if you look at the timeline, which needs to be updated a little bit, given what we did and didn't do today, that we are going to start sharing with you all sections of the revised report. And when I say revised, you'll see red lines comparing the version, the new version, to the version that you've already reviewed. And those revisions are based on the comments that were submitted during the call or through email on those specific sections. Now, it is hoped that we're not going to go through yet another round of revisions, but that we can basically have this as our final version of the initial report language, unless there are strong objections to something that was changed. In other words, that it shouldn't have been changed based on the discussions. So it's a very, we're not intending this to be a whole other round of discussions on each of the sections. And then moving on, we have a full working group meeting on the 18th. And then on Wednesday, it was our hope to share the full initial report on the wiki. And although I am trying to push for Monday, July 2nd, I noticed that staff put in Tuesday, July 3rd. I'm still going to try to get them to move that back to Monday, July 2nd, to officially publish the initial report for public comment. We're going to send correspondence to the board, inviting them to submit public comment, and then send an email to ICANN.org as well to invite them to submit public comment as well. The intent is to have a approximately 60-day public comment period. That's 60. So to end the public comment period around September 3rd. That is a Wednesday. That gives 20 more days than normal in a public comment period, but that also recognizes the fact that it is summer in the Northern Hemisphere, and a lot of people will undoubtedly be on vacation. September 3rd is a Monday. Okay, then my calendar is off. I was looking at the wrong thing. Let me see. I'm sorry, Karen, you're right. 3rd is a Monday. It should be the 5th, Wednesday. I'm sorry, September 5th. Sorry, Steve, do you want to jump in for a second while I am getting a drink of water?
Sure, Jeff. Thanks. This is Steve from staff. Just to, I guess, add a couple other points to what Jeff is saying. The intention is to – so the level of detail in the – I guess the work plan just for the initial report is – fairly high detail, and it tries to show a clear path of how we can accomplish what we're trying to accomplish and by what time. And so the intention after we get things published for public comment or the initial report is to try to develop a work plan on the other side about how we get to a final report. You know, a meeting by meeting description of what topics we want to talk about and try to give everyone a clearer sense of how we're going to get to the end. I think part of that discussion, and I think this will be part of the agenda at ICANN 62, is to talk about how we organize this working group, whether or not there are subteams of some sort again, or whether or not it's a full plenary, or whatever the case may be. I think the idea is to put forward some proposals of how we could organize our work afterwards, and then get some insight from the working group members and the rest of the community about how it makes sense to organize. And then once we get a sense of how that is going to take place, then we can, of course, try to develop a more detailed work plan that helps to provide clarity. Jeff, I don't know if you're able to speak again, but it's about what I wanted to add.
Yeah, no, thank you very much. So are there any – Justine, you have your hand raised, but I think that's an old hand. So anyone else that's got any questions on this work plan, at least to get us to ICANN and beyond? No. Okay. Everyone's perfectly good at that. Christopher says that we need the CCT report and WorkTrack 5 report before the PDP can put forward a final document for public comment. Okay. We still want to see the CCT review report, so there's no debate there. And we could talk about the other part about WorkTrack 5, I think, later on this year when we see what their path is and whether that notion is true that we need to have a WorkTrack 5 report before we can have a final document on these issues. So we will obviously be paying attention to that, but we'll test that theory out, Christopher, a little later this year. Anne, please, you have your hand raised.
Yeah, thanks, Jeff. I'm not sure what you were asking about in terms of is everyone okay with that. I was curious as to when we'll be discussing 1.9.
So there is a call on Monday, so we will get through that on Monday, as well as a host of other things.
What's the host of other things?
So we're going to put out the revisions to all the sections so that we're going to ask for any comments or objections on the revisions to each of the sections. And we'll also have a draft of a preamble letter that you all will see. So we still have some work to do next week before everyone leaves for Panama.
That's great. Just really quickly, I know Karen is on the call. And Karen, I would like to ask that you review the post that I put to the list about reflecting the conversations that occurred on Work Track 3 on more than one occasion about my concerns that we are getting into the area of content when we talk about which type of community applications should be eligible as communities, and my concerns about freedom of expression there. It would be extremely helpful if you could take a look back at the transcripts about those concerns and that they might be, you know, reflected a little bit more emphasis given to that freedom of expression issue. Thank you.
Thanks, Anne. And Karen's in the queue. So, Karen, please.
Sorry, my mute button got buried. I need three monitors with having to open my own document and all this stuff. And I just wanted to say, Robin is on vacation this week, but we have already been emailing and working on language. So, yeah, we're on it. And hopefully we'll get through 8-2 and get on to 9 on Monday. Thanks.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Karen.
I mean, technically, we still have 5 minutes. I could get through 1.8.2 in 5 minutes. But,
I'll go for it, Jeff. Try and get through 1.8.2 in 5 minutes.
Everybody needs a drink. Let us go.
Yeah. Anyway, just please review these sections. 1.8.2, I'm not going to really start, but just say that there is a discussion in there about an appeals mechanism, which we had a discussion about in Work Track 3. And this relates to whether or not an action or inaction of not just the board or the staff, but evaluators on a particular application should be reviewable from a substantive viewpoint or procedural viewpoint. So please do read that. It is something that is very new and that will need quite a bit of work. And one of the questions or topics we may talk about in ICANN 62 is if we did develop this appeals mechanism, what kinds of questions and what kinds of things would we need to consider in developing that appeal? So I think it's a new concept. It's something that I think is very interesting and valuable. And so please come to the call ready to discuss that issue as well as 1.9. The next meeting is Monday, as was just posted, June 18th at 1500 UTC for 90 minutes. So we have a lot of stuff to do, and thank you, everyone. I know that this was a long call, lots of stuff covered, but there's a light at the end of the tunnel, at least for the initial report. So thank you, everyone. And for those on the East Coast, have a good night. For those in Europe or Asia, have a good morning and the rest of the day. Thank you, everyone.
And thanks, Jeff. Thanks, everyone. Let's power through on Monday. All of our objections have all been duly noted. I trust we won't have to go over them again on that call. Bye for now.
Thank you so much. Meeting has been adjourned. Operator, please stop the recordings and disconnect all remaining lines. Have a great day, everyone.